All right. Welcome. Thank you all for coming to the second quarterly community safety meeting. I apologize for the delay. Just a little bit of a microphone issue. So if at any point you can't hear me, please say something in the chat or wave your hand. I'm Megan Drake. I'm the crime prevention officer here at the River Forest Police Department, and we're happy to bring you this meeting live on Zoom. Published slides and video recording of the meeting will be made available after the slide presentation. We will begin by reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with justice for all. Thank you. Before we get started with tonight's presentations, we're going to have a word from our Chief of Police, Chief O'Shea.
Good evening, everyone. I'd like to welcome everyone that's in our audience tonight, whether you're on Zoom or whether you're physically here at the River Forest Village Hall. Today is the 24th. It's Wednesday, and it's coming up to about 5:37. There's some great guest speakers tonight. You're going to hear from the event coordinator for the fourth annual River Forest Community Bike Exchange, Lindsay Silver. And then we're going to also have a presentation done by Sergeant Stephen Bies of the Edison Police Department, who's going to talk about police response to autistic individuals. Our own crime prevention officer, Megan Drake, is going to talk about sensory kits, National Prescription Take-Back Day, and services that are free of charge that the police department provides to the community. Our last speaker tonight is going to be Detective Denise Umeno. That's going to talk about some of the crime trends and also some of the safety tips you can use to combat some of these trends. I also want to mention, we talk about locking everything up, using your alarms, your lights, and we've noticed with the residents have really stepped up and have been doing it and taking a very good approach to their own personal safety and their neighbor's safety. And we've seen that in multiple occasions, which have prevented thefts, prevented burglaries, and we hope to continue that. In the meantime, there still is a lot of groups out there right now that are targeting our construction vehicles, that are targeting our retail theft, or conducting retail thefts at our retail business establishments. And that's an ongoing challenge that we are managing. Without further ado, I'd like to have event coordinator Lindsay Silver step up for our first presentation of the evening.
Hi, good evening. I'm participating tonight on Zoom. Thank you for the introduction. Are you okay? Megan, can everyone hear me? Okay.
Pause for 1 second, Lindsay, please.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's right. All right, great. So I'm so excited to be back. This is the second year presenting about the bike exchange, and it's a really fun year to present on because we did have a record-breaking year, and we've talked about what a record-breaking year means for us. And I think that for those of you who have heard about or participated in the bike exchange, you know it was really a grassroots effort to start and has continued to grow. So I'm going to share just a little presentation that I made with some of the fun pictures and tell you a little bit more about the bike exchange in case you are less familiar with it. So let's see. All right, so this was the fourth year. It sort of goes in order. It's 2024, and it's the fourth year we've been doing this. I say, about the bike exchange, this is really like going back to that grassroots effort. This is the inside of my garage, my husband and myself, and really the whole idea started just thinking about if I don't know if any of you look at bike resale or just buying new bikes, but it's a really big market, and even the resale community are selling used bikes for a very high price. And so figuring out a way to really promote sustainability, keeping bikes out of the landfills, And just really doing something great for the community. I think that any of you with children know that almost every year while they're in a certain phase of life, they're really needing a new bike every year. So this is a fun way for you to be able to get a new bike with very, very limited effort and financial cost. So this year we had it on Saturday, April 13th. So just a couple of years ago, I show where the bike exchange started. So this is when our very first year doing it was in 2021. It was really the first event in River Forest that had taken place since COVID. And so we were all outside in our masks. I like to say that we had this idea that we could start this event and just really had no idea how many people would show up. So I like looking back at this picture because you look at the number of volunteers that were there, and it was very few of us. We've grown fairly significantly over the years. So explaining how you participate in the bike exchange, the sort of the true essence of the event is actually exchanging a bike. So you bring a bike and then you can take a bike, and it's as simple as that. A lot of people drop off their bikes to our house the week leading up to the event. This year I think it was 158 or 168 bikes were collected in advance of the exchange, which was a huge wow for us. And especially because the previous year, I think the highest we ever got to was maybe 85 bikes dropped off in advance. So those people, when they come to the event, they get a little token that they can use so that we know that they've donated, and they can just go in and really shop for a bike, and then they drop the token when they leave and get to take a bike with them. The other way to participate, of course, is that people just donate bikes. It's people cleaning out their garages. We take bikes in any condition, so even if they're unrideable, missing a seat, we got, I think, at least four bikes without seats on them, missing different parts and pieces. We'll use those as we're repairing bikes, and then we actually, you'll see, donate everything that we can't, that doesn't get taken to Working Bikes, who does a lot of great things with them. The other thing you could do is to come without donating a bike or dropping anything off, and just making a donation. So we take cash, Zelle, Venmo, and it's really at everyone's discretion. It is meant to be a community event. It's not really at the essence about raising money. It's more or less just getting people out here. So we don't ask for a large donation. And then, of course, what's important with the audience here and now is being able to come and register your bike with the Village of River Forest Police Department, which I don't know if this is even true, but I always tell everyone it's the only event of the year where you can come and get your sticker right then and there, in person. You don't have to do the online form and wait for it to come in the mail. You can actually get it right then and have the police department put it on your bike for you. So just a little bit about how we prepare. Lots of marketing, and mostly all through Facebook. We send flyers home at all three D90 schools, but really push it a lot through social media. We have a few different things that we like to do to get ready. We started a few years ago with these stickers, and so the one you see actually on the bike was the first year. The second year we went with these die cut stickers, and the third year I didn't put a picture in, but they're like holograms. So the coolest thing ever is when we see bikes come back in that have already been through the exchange. It's really, really that makes us all super happy to see. And then I just put this little bucket on the front steps, and people start dropping off bikes all week long, and then log them right there. Friday night is a big night for us. We had, I think there was 13 volunteers at the house that, if you see that third picture, those were of all the bikes that got checked. Working Bikes donates tire tubes to us. So we make sure all the bikes have air, that they're safe and rideable. And if they're not, we tag them with exactly what needs to be fixed that we might not be able to do ourselves. And so you can, when you come to the event, you can actually take one of those bikes, and just know that you might just have to take it to a bike shop to be professionally repaired, with something beyond what we can do. But that picture of the yard one is like just my small backyard covered in bikes. And I think that, it really, this year was a huge wow to see all of those things there. So the money that we raise, 3 of the 4 years has gone back to Green for Good. So this year being one of those years again, Green for Good is a D90 initiative at Lincoln, Roosevelt, and Willard, and it's really promoting sustainability within the schools. A big part of it is, of course, educating kids on sustainability. Right now, we're in the middle of Earth Week at all D90 schools, and so there's lots of different ways that we can use that money to help with education. So it's really at the discretion of those schools and a great cause within the community. So some new things this year. We worked with Mr. Peters at Lincoln, and he actually made these really cool wooden tokens that you see on the left. Those are the ones that instead of getting a raffle ticket when you walked in, if you had dropped off a bike, you got one of these wooden tokens. And on the other side, has the Green for Good logo. Just making it something fun that we can reuse every year without having to go with disposable raffle tickets. Then we also had Card My Yard as a sponsor this year, who made the bike drop very, very obvious this year in front of the house. In the past, I was joking, we'd use just like an old one of those neighborhood election signs or whatever, and wrapped it with paper, and it was so small, and just stuck that in the yard to show that it was the bike drop. So this year, everyone knew where it was. And then last, we decided to do a raffle. So we talked about how we sometimes receive really, really amazing bikes. The Tandem is one that we'd certainly consider a special bike. But sometimes people bring bikes in that they leave that are, I mean, really worth like $800 or $900 bikes. And so this year we decided, instead of just having it be like if you were lucky and you were there, you got it, we did a raffle for any specialty bike that came in. So we had six of them, and then people could spend $5 to enter the raffle. We decided to keep it at a low cost and limit it to only two tickets per person to buy, just so that it could really be affordable for anyone who wanted to participate. And so that, again, was something really fun and great. And then the event day, this is the actual picture from this year. That line wrapped, this is the back parking lot of Roosevelt. It wrapped all the way down that corner and around for about an hour and a half. We had a really, really tremendous support and number of people who attended this year. And you can see sort of this is what the bikes look like when we first got them set up in the morning. Last year, that when I did this presentation, I think it said snow, hail, rain, or something. This year, it's sunshine, root beer, and bike bingo. So we had the most gorgeous day probably of 2024 so far, and just some pictures to highlight it. We had Spoke Cafe there. When we had first met and talked to him about his participation, he was like, well, maybe if it's nice enough, I could do root beer floats. And I was like, just, you can't ever be too sure. So we had hot coffee and Nitro Brew and root beer floats. And it was a big success. And then the bike bingo, like I mentioned, that we were selling. And then that was just a screenshot from my phone because I was obsessing over the weather for, as you can imagine, the entire week leading up to it. So just beautiful forecast. And then this year's numbers. The numbers to me are like just the big wow. We had 273 bikes donated compared to 200 last year. So it's really a huge percentage increase. We had $1,595 donated through the people that were making donations that were taking bikes that hadn't done an actual exchange. So more than $400 more than last year. Another almost a similar increase in terms of percentage that we saw with the donated bikes. And then 85 bikes registered, which is a huge jump because I think that 40 that I used last year, it might have been more like 38. And I was feeling sad about the number. So we published 40, but 85 bikes registered with the police department, which is just really, I think, a huge success overall. And then the leftover bikes. So I mentioned Working Bikes earlier. They have been an amazing partner for us. They, like I mentioned, they donate the tire tubes. Which if you were to go to the store and buy your own tire tube, they're usually around $10 each. And then if you had it professionally done at any of the local shops, it's around $25 to $35 to have a tube, replaced in your bike. And we're doing all of that for free. So this is just some of the volunteers after loading up, the truck, the kids were helping, counting the bikes. We donated 90 bikes to Working Bikes this year, which I think was a comparison to 65 last year. So really, again, another great increase of numbers. And then our volunteer crew this year, we just have the most amazing volunteers. Everyone, I think that one of them said that, and I had recapped this in a post, that it's like working at the bike exchange or volunteering at the bike exchange is like this nonstop endorphin rush where like every few minutes you just get like another happy moment one after the next. And so it's a really great day, and a lot, and especially nice when it's not hailing outside. We did get more sponsors and partners this year, Spoke Cafe, ASI, which is an employee benefits company, Ovation Dental, which is a local River Forest dentist office, Working Bikes, as I mentioned, and Card My Yard. So this really just recaps everything that I'd already mentioned with a great shot in action of the police department doing the bike registrations. I think it's great. I mean, they kept not it wasn't too lengthy of a line, but they kept a really solid stream of people lining up to register their bikes throughout the entire day. So this is it. We had a nice article written up by the Wednesday Journal, and are excited for next year, which will be the 5th anniversary. So going to try to do something special for that, and more to come. We've announced the date. If you want to save the date for next year, I just want to make sure I'm saying the right date. I think it's April 12th, 2025. It's April 12th, 2025. And just a reminder, I mean, this is open to beyond River Forest residents. It's also the neighboring communities. So feel free to invite friends and family to come and join us. Thank you.
Lindsay, thank you so much for coming and presenting that over Zoom. It was a really great event. Like she said, we did register 85 bikes, which is great. It really helps us if your bike is lost or stolen. It helps us locate that much faster if possible. So thank you again. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Megan.
Our next guest speaker is Sergeant Bies, who retired from the Addison Police Department after 20 plus years. He served in various areas of law enforcement, including field services, school resource officer, criminal investigations, field training officer, and much more. He is one of the instructors for the 40-hour crisis intervention course that our officers attend. In that course, Sergeant Bies instructs police officers on how to respond to individuals with autism and other special needs. And as April is Autism Awareness Month, we are pleased to have Sergeant Bies as our guest speaker. And Sergeant, I will turn it over to you. Thank you very much for being here with us today.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be on with you this evening. As mentioned, my name is Stefan Bies. I spent 20 plus years in law enforcement. I retired about 2 years ago. I am now the Assistant Director of Campus Safety at North Central College, so in downtown Naperville. But as I mentioned, I am one of the instructors for the 40-hour crisis intervention training that many officers have gone through throughout the state of Illinois. And specifically, I cover the portion of the class relating to autism and intellectual and developmental disabilities. So as I go through and I talk about trained law enforcement and how to respond to individuals with an intellectual or developmental disability, a big part of what I do also is parent training, because really creating a level of understanding is a two-way street. It's what we need to understand as law enforcement, but we also want families and parents to understand how we are going to respond to certain things and what our duties are as law enforcement officers. We'll kind of talk about a couple of different variations and things that we can do to keep our loved ones safe at home and also in the community. So what we talk about is special needs law enforcement and parents and why it's so important for us to understand some of these characteristics. So I kind of start with the why and why I kind of do this presentation for law enforcement and parents as well. Why do I have computer issues tonight? It was a letter that came into my chief probably about 7, 8 years ago. And what he summary with the email says is that he had his concerns if he had to contact our agency for assistance with his son. And his son was one of my students when I was a school resource officer. And I understood his son's disability. His son is now 22 years
FYI,
of age.
you have
He
stopped
is.
sharing your screen. So we're seeing background, or if there's an issue, just let us know.
Yeah, I don't know why I'm having issues here.
Okay.
Let's do this.
Do you have two monitors or one?
No, I just have the one. I don't know why we're having issues. Sure. How about now?
Better. There we go.
Okay.
Good to go.
All right. So this email came into my chief. And what this father is saying is he had his concerns if he had to contact our agency for assistance with his son. And his son was one of my students when I was a school resource officer. I was very familiar with his son. And his son has a severe form of autism. His son is now 22 years of age. He is now bigger than his dad because he's about 5'10", about 225 pounds. But he's also nonverbal, meaning he can't tell you what's going on and why he's upset. So I knew there was instances where my department, our agency, and the officers that I supervise might respond to this individual's residence for assistance with his son. And I wanted to make sure that my officers understood his disability and the disabilities of some of the people that resided in our town. Again, this topic is very, very personal to me. My two youngest sons have autism, and they were diagnosed about 10 years ago. So I had my concerns if I had to call my own agency where I live, would they understand my son's disability? So which is why I started training law enforcement about this. Okay, so for all of us parents with loved ones with special needs, we know there's some major impairments with our loved ones associated with their disability, right? And one of those things is lack of social skills. A lot of times it sometimes will display inappropriate or behaviors that can be seen as sometimes aggressive or self-injurious behavior. A lot of times they'll display restrictive or repetitive mannerisms. And for us parents, we know that's stimming, which is a really good thing for us. And obviously there's difficulty in communicating. We know that there is a limited verbal ability with those with disabilities. So the way the disability affects our loved ones can lead to disability. Lead to areas that can lead to significant misunderstandings during emergency situations and interactions with first responders. So now let's consider this from a different perspective. From a law enforcement perspective, we have somebody that's non-communicative that may be interpreted by the law enforcement officer as being uncooperative or dismissive, but individuals displaying lack of eye contact, which we know is a common characteristic of several disabilities. We, the law enforcement officer, may interpret that as lying or hiding of something. The display of those odd mannerisms, those restrictive or repetitive mannerisms that many of our loved ones display, can be interpreted as being under the influence of a drug or an alcohol. Unusual social interactions, echolalia. So my boys have echolalia, which is they're repeating the last phrase that they hear. Sometimes a law enforcement officer might interpret that as kind of being a wise guy. We also understand that social boundaries are difficult, and a lot of our loved ones don't understand those social boundaries and may stand too close. And on occasion, law enforcement officers may interpret that as being confrontational, placing their hands in their pockets, and it's just we again display those restrictive and repetitive mannerisms. We need to see that as an officer safety concern. And in some instances, our loved ones may touch stuff on our uniforms, right? Those shiny nameplates and badges and all the equipment we carry can be very intriguing for an individual with a disability. But a law enforcement officer may interpret that as a threat to them or somebody else. So it's really important that we create this level of understanding between our families and the law enforcement officers that serve our communities. Right? Law enforcement officers may not understand a lot of this. Big thing is law enforcement officers don't know what they don't know. When I went to the academy over two decades ago, there was no training on how to interact with somebody with a disability, and there was definitely no training relating to autism. But we're seeing that try to change. We're seeing that these training programs evolve across the country, specifically here in Illinois as well. Okay. And truthfully, for the longest time, officers were not properly trained. So we've seen multiple incidents across the nation where characteristics of the disability have been misinterpreted as a crime, and which is what we're trying to prevent, and trying to create that book. But it's, again, it's a two-way street with our families as well. Autism in the criminal justice system. Okay, and research shows that prevalence of rates for specifically autism is only about 1% of the population, but they are seven times more likely to have contact with law enforcement and are significantly higher for being a victim of crime. Becomes that up to 10 to 12 times higher than an individual without a disability. This is why it's really, really critical that we understand some of this. And I do a lot of training on, especially with law enforcement agencies, different organizations about our loved ones being victims of crime just because they're easily manipulated, have troubles detecting deceit, maybe lack that expressive communication to be able to disclose that they were a victim of a crime, making a lot of the statistics very, very underreported because of that. Autism and age, and this is one of the biggest things. My boys are getting older. They're now 14 and 12. So when they were kids with a disability, some of their problem behaviors were kind of seen or accepted as part of the disability. But as they grow older into late teens and even early adulthood, some of those attitudes will start to shift. And some of those unusual behaviors may shift to suspicion as opposed to acceptance, which we once saw when they were younger. So aggressive behaviors that are often displayed with those with disabilities now becomes a battery or a crime. Invasion of personal space becomes stalking, pocketing furred items. And this is one of the things that my boys did is if they like something, they just took it. At 4 or 5 years old, that's acceptable. But at now an adult, that's a theft or a retail theft. And then playing in parks, we know many of our loved ones with disabilities, their mindset may not match their physical appearance. So if you have a grown adult male playing in a park with other kids that aren't his, that is definitely a situation where law enforcement may get called. And that's how these interactions kind of manifest themselves and how we have those kind of these interactions with especially young adults and adults with disabilities. Okay. Emotional regulation, we know, is a common characteristics of those with disabilities. So low frustration or fear, anxiety, sadness. May lose control because they don't have that emotional regulation skills that those without a disability may have, may or may not be able to effectively communicate with a loved one, first responder, or something like that. And because of that, they will often resort to some dangerous strategies, like using confrontational language, withdrawing or wandering, avoiding or fleeing, and physical contact are all kind of things that we see. We know a lot of times when there's somebody's nonverbal, specifically with autism, they will just try to avoid an uncomfortable situation. And that's that escape behavior or function of behavior that we'll see. And they'll just avoid that confrontation whatsoever. But if somebody tries to walk away or flee us from law enforcement, that can pose a problem because we may interpret that as you're trying to be uncooperative or hiding it or being part of some crime in the area. What I tell families to do is if you have an issue with your loved one with a mental health disorder, a disability, even our elderly with Alzheimer's or dementia, when you're contacting law enforcement, I tell families to specifically ask for a CIT officer or a crisis intervention team trained officer. And these officers receive specialized training in how to recognize and interact with people with a wide variety of disabilities. So autism, intellectual developmental disabilities, but also mental health disorders. And it's a different mindset and a different type of training for our CIT officers where they're going in and trying to de-escalate the situation and then offer resources. So it's more of that assistance part of it as opposed to that criminal enforcement part of it. Many organizations, my previous department as well, collaborated with mental health resources in our community, whether it was our in-house social services, mental health workers, veterans affairs, and different organizations within our community to help work through some of these issues that we're responding to. So I tell families, if you have an issue with your loved one with a disability, when you do contact 911 or do call law enforcement for assistance, please request a CIT or a crisis intervention trained officer to respond. Officer safety is obviously a huge concern for us as law enforcement. And while we're trying to increase that awareness of understanding what the disabilities are, there are still some situations where officers have to have their guard up and avoiding dangerous situations. And sometimes there is protocols that must be followed in the interest of safety for all in emergency solve situations. I train law enforcement officers who can avoid physical confrontation with somebody with a disability who's escalated. That's great. But I also train them that sometimes they're just these physical interactions are just unavoidable. But I also talk about how to respond and what to expect if there's a hands-on or use of force situation with someone with a disability. But again, there are just some situations that are just unavoidable for safety concerns across for everybody involved, whether it's the officers, bystanders, or that individual. Okay. Preparation makes a huge difference, though. Countless situations might result in contact with first responders. Okay. These contacts are riskier when first responders are insufficiently trained. Okay. Maybe even riskier when a care provider, a person with autism or intellectual or developmental disability has not considered these emergency situations. And this is where we can do our part as parents, and its preparation is critical in these situations of how we handle emergency type situations. Okay. Thing is, we don't know, right? We never know when an emergency situation is going to arise. These emergencies occur in our daily life. So car accidents, house fires, major crisis, natural disasters are all things that we can that can be unexpected. And this is where our community partnerships are really, really critical. Helping identify some of these public safety or criminal justice type situations and provide possible solutions so that individuals with disabilities can be prepared for that, stay safe, and even better, avoid a lot of these situations. So there's some resources that we've put out. I put out my old previous department and I share with law enforcement across the state when I train, our social stories, right? We're preparing our individuals for how an event may or may not occur, and giving that frame of reference of how what's appropriate way to respond to certain things. Okay? In the home, with our disabilities, we know that they may or may not understand danger. So kitchen stoves, strangers at the door, electronics, hygiene, communication, weather, temperature, safety are all things that we can address. These are all things that we can work on as parents, or guardians or loved ones of individuals with disability and preparing them for staying safe at home, but also out in the community. Okay. So windows in a car, windows, seat belts, generally distracting behavior. In my case, my sons have had concerning behavior while we were driving. It becomes very, very dangerous. So I tell parents, pull over and resolve the situation before we get on the road again. Parking lots, my kids don't have a really great concept of fear. And because of that, they will oftentimes put themselves in dangerous situations, or not because they want to, but they're just not aware of it. So parking lots, crossing the streets, things like that. These are all things that we can work on prior to an emergency occurring. In the front of an emergency in your home, things, especially in instances where there is a fire in the home, like sensory issues are a huge part of that, right? There are some things out there that actually, as opposed to a normal smoke detector, it is a actually voice activated, where it plays a voice as opposed to an actually the noise that we see. A lot of times, our loved ones with disabilities will seek out a safe place and hide during these situations. And there may be some resistance or fear of those individuals in uniforms. We'll talk a little bit more, but we want our loved ones to understand that first responders are there to help. And they're seen as authority figures. And we really need to understand and listen to what those first responders are saying and keeping them safe. Okay. Breaking down of routines or preparing things are ahead of time. Each shape routine should be kind of broken down into manageable steps, right? Distinct, should we have both visual and written directions on those? My boys are very visual learners, so we use a lot of social stories or picture resources. We want to teach those basic first steps and build off of that. Practice increasing real life scenarios and settings and reinforce that success. That positive reinforcement is huge in preparing them for these emergency situations. These social narratives, like I said, using the social stories is a wonderful thing. In a reference in this one, the PAAutismproject.org has a lot of free social stories for families. They're a free resource. I hand them out to law enforcement across the country and sharing them. There's tons of situations out there where you're creating that kind of point of reference of how these situations may or may occur. We'll be traveling for the summer. We have a social story of how TSA is going to go. Preparing my boys are going through in the travel. Okay. So it's really important that we have these point of references. And again, a lot of the police departments are have these resources and can work with families in their communities. One of the big things that I start to see, and I'm doing some more and more training on this with law enforcement as well, is understanding of boundaries with our loved ones. And again, we talked about it, but our individuals with disabilities are significantly higher rates of being victims of crime. And a lot of that's just not understanding about what understanding boundaries are. So what I use as a great visual is a relationship circle for appropriate behavior, who you go with, who you don't ever go with, who you talk to, who you do talk to. Where do our police and firefighters kind of fall in this circle? So that orange area is that individual. And your blue area is your next closest, and that is your family. Those are the individuals you trust the most, that you talk to, you can go with. And in friendship, depending on your friends, who are they, and how close their relationship is really critical. And then your next, your yellow ring is your acquaintances, people you know in the neighborhood, but we not necessarily go with those individuals or speak with those individuals or go in their homes. Community helpers, this is where our law enforcement, our first responders would fall in, where it's safe to interact with them and understand them and know where those boundaries are. But again, we really don't know if we really want to go with a first responder unless it's an emergency type situation. And that outer ring is our strangers. And those are the people that we want to stress the importance of never going with them, talking about stranger danger, not communicating with them if they approach us. What are some safe things to do? And again, really understanding those boundaries of where these individuals should fit. Missing children is a huge part. We know with specifically with autism, our loved ones are significantly higher rates of elopement or wandering from a safe environment, whether it be schools, homes. But we see many, many times, and I've responded to countless incidents in my own jurisdiction where I worked, of individuals or kids with autism that have wandered from a safe environment. So what do we do when it happens? First, we always tell parents, first, search your house first. It's one of the biggest things. And when law enforcement arrives, they're going to search the house again. But we want to be sure that individual is not in the house. And if they're located in the house, that's wonderful. We've averted a crisis situation. But if they're not, we don't want to waste time looking outside of the house when they're in the house or vice versa, right? A lot of parents, there will be a delay in contacting law enforcement. They think, well, we'll search for them first, sort of thing. But we know that time is critical. Every minute, every second that individual's out in the community unaccompanied, we know that they can put themselves in dangerous situations depending on the severity of the disability. Same thing with schools. A lot of times we have seen it, and there's a great example in this picture of Avante Kendo. He wandered from a school in New York City, and it was a significant portion of time passed before law enforcement was contacted. And Avante was eventually located. He had drowned, and they found him several months after he was reported missing. The school waited a significant portion of time before contacting law enforcement. So I please, 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 in these missing children situations, please contact law enforcement for assistance. We have the ability to deploy resources very, very quickly in the help of that search. The longer we wait, the harder it becomes. A lot of parents, I know there's fear of apprehension calling for the fear of having DCFS or child welfare organization involved, fear of being arrested for child neglect or abuse. That is not the case. Again, as part of the training with law enforcement, we know that individuals with disabilities wander at significant rates. So it's not necessarily always a neglect issue. It is just you're human, and there are moments where it just happens. Even the most diligent parents have had their loved ones alone from the state environment. Set those fears aside and call. Seconds count, especially in these types of cases. So please contact law enforcement. So other things to consideration is identification for our loved ones. We partnered with a program in Anniston. When I was there, we partnered with Medical Alert. They have a program called LEAP. It's Law Enforcement Agency Portal. It is a free program where you pre-register your loved one with the police department, and they will issue out a medical alert bracelet with their information and an individualized serial number on there. What I tell first responders is many times you will find an individual with disabilities who has not been reported missing, but you recover them, but they may be nonverbal. So how do we reunite this individual with their family if they can't communicate with us? This is where the identification is critical. We provided our young teens or younger adults that were out and about the community, in autism information cards. It's a way for them to disclose their disability to law enforcement without maybe having the ability to say it. There are some programs across the country. Florida has one. Maryland is another one. They have a blue envelope program. And what the blue envelope program is on a traffic stop, that individual with a disability will provide their license insurance in a blue envelope. And a blue envelope is an indicator to law enforcement that that individual has a disability. And the envelope will actually explain, on the outer parts of the envelope, will actually explain what that disability is and letting the officer know what they may be interacting with. Premise alert programs. In the state of Illinois, law enforcement agencies and/or their dispatch centers, by law, are required to have a premise alert program. And basically, it is a special needs registry. That's a great way for us as law enforcement to understand, as we're responding to a particular address, that an individual may or may not have a disability. I know from a parent's perspective, there is some apprehensiveness about registering your loved one, but I will tell you, it is really, really critical that we have all pertinent information as law enforcement if respond to that resident. I will tell you, my own two sons are registered in my local jurisdiction because I want our officers to understand my son's disabilities, and prepare for that if we have to call them. Another suggestion is please don't put your loved one's information on their outer parts of their clothing. An individual who's looking to victimize someone may see that and be calling my name and be like, "Oh, they must know me. Hey, I know your mom, Andrew." Well, it's not the case, but they picked up on that cue. So it's okay to have identifiers so that your loved one in their clothing, just not on the outside of it where somebody could see it, is really important things to keeping them safe. Things that you can do, have concrete, detailed, frequent conversations with your child about rules, talking to strangers, staying in the yard or caregivers, talk to others about concerns, establish a phone tree for an action plan. We'll talk about a neighbor's letter, one of some of the resources that we submitted to our families. Listen, watch, and learn. Try to understand why your child does certain things, and anticipate potential issues. If we know they're a wandering or a loper, I'm preparing for that. When we had no wandering elopement event, I followed up with every single family when we had one because I wanted to know what triggered that event. What was the function of that behavior? Why did it happen? What places were they going? Because that really does help us in that search. Address issues such as bullying at school, ensure policies are in place, increase those autism awareness with students. If you're a parent with this loved one with a disability, understand what a battle it can be with the school districts, but stay strong and stay in the fight with that, with the school districts. Enroll your children in the swimming lessons. If he or she does not know how to swim, we want to prepare them for that because we know that drowning is a very, very real possibility, especially with children with autism. We know there's a strong attraction to water, so we want them to be safe in those situations. Some other resources we have, especially these registries, is critical. We provided our families with a 911 script. And why this is so important is if you have an emergency situation, your loved one is eloped, there's something going on, you're going to forget the most basic information because you're throwing in stress, fear, anxiety, all these different emotions. You're going to forget even the basic information. So what you're doing is you're preparing the script ahead of time, with important information that first responders would need. For our dispatchers in my town, they had a script as well, which mirrored the 911 script that we gave to families. So it was very easy and kind of flowed together very nicely. Neighbor letters, we provided these for our families as well. And it was up to the particular family. Some families wanted their close neighbors to know that they had a loved one with a disability. And if they saw them unattended or out and about by themselves, to immediately contact the family, but then contact 911. Some families are comfortable with this, others are not. And I totally respect any family, the decision they make, but it was a resource that we wanted to provide. Again, those autism identifiers, whether it's a bracelet, a shoe tag, some form of identifiers, indicating the disability is present is really, really critical. And safety plans, develop those safety plans. Many law enforcement agencies will work with families to create that safety plan. We did in my jurisdiction. We always worked with our families to create those safety plans. There are tremendous resources right in your backyard that you can work with. Okay. Get to know those neighbors, fill out that personal ID records, think about anticipate issues as they arise, ensure that individual has effective means of communication, right? How does our loved one communicate? Are they verbal? Are they nonverbal? Will they respond to their name? Do they use an assistive technology device for all critical things and things that we would need to know as law enforcement? practice them relaying that information. Even in stressful situations, they need to be able to relay that information to law enforcement. We practiced and practiced and practiced with my own two boys, but when you threw in stress, they were about 50-50 about re responding to that information. So having other forms of communication may be very, very important. Tips for parents, especially working with your law enforcement agencies, let them know their first responders are trusted authority, right? Tell them to keep their hands in plain sight while speaking with the police, and tell them to do their best at answering those questions, okay? Provide them with that personal identification and having them identify themselves and possibly identify their disability. Have a meet and greet with your first responders. What we're starting to see a lot of agencies doing, and we did it in my agency, was we're having meet and greets, special needs events. We had a soccer program we worked with. The Elgin Police Department has a huge event every year. They just had theirs past Saturday called Heroes Unite, and it's incorporating their special needs community again with those first responders. Encourage your law enforcement agencies, fire, EMTs, EMS, to host quality special needs training, right? We need to train as many of our first responders as we possibly can about what you are going to see with some of our particular individual and disabilities. As parents, you are your loved one's best advocate. Find an officer or another professional agency who has a relative with special needs. That was my motivation with me. It obviously affected me. And I was a tremendous advocate for our special needs families in my jurisdiction because it was a very personal touch to me. So, which the numbers are statistically, we're going to have an officer in that agency that has a loved one with a disability and find that person out. But as parents, be your loved one's advocate and be that voice for them. Kind of enclosure, law enforcement, parents, we have the ability to enhance the safety of our loved ones if we reduce some exposure to liability. One, law enforcement recognizes the behaviors and signs of autism. Practice tolerance and patient communication skills and follow some procedures to ensure the safety and cooperation of a person with autism. But our parents, we need to do our part as well, right? And working with our first responder agencies as much as we possibly can. I know we kind of looked through a lot of this, and there's a lot of things we probably did leave out, but we're under time crunch a little bit. But that is my email address. That is my website. I am happy to field questions from parents. I am happy to field questions from law enforcement officers. I field questions all the time on a very, very regular basis. So I'm happy to do those. For parents that are looking for resources or things like that, they want to share with their agencies. You can always reach out to me as well, and I'm happy to share anything that I have with you. And you can clearly share it with your law enforcement agencies. Are there, I know we kind of went through a lot of this. Are there any questions?
Man, per shift.
How many what?
Does he recommend per shift?
How many qualified CITs do you recommend per shift? This is a question from a member of our audience.
I don't think you had to have a specific number. You really want your best trained officers is what it really what it is. I mean, if you have a couple on each shift, that's wonderful. We typically had at least one CIT officer on every shift in my jurisdiction, responding to certain things. It was very, very important. We had multiple CITs on shifts, so my recommendation would be at least be a couple. But if I again, jurisdictions, I completely understand that they may not have those resources available, and it may only be one officer, and it's okay. Really, CIT is a mindset, so. Those officers that are really engaged with their communities are very passionate about the topic are usually your best ones. So it's a really good question. Any other questions?
Sorry to guys, thank you so much for your time and spending all that time talking to us about all that. It's very important and it's been helpful to our agency. So thank you very much.
You are very welcome. Again, if anybody has questions, you can always reach out to me. I'm happy to answer them. And if I don't have the answer, I'll find them for you. So.
Thank you. Sorry. Thank you. Sorry.
One second.
Button on the side.
So here we just have, I put up a few more pictures of the bike exchange that we participated in on April 13th. It really was a great event. And like I said, the 85 bikes that we registered, it really is beneficial to you and it's helpful to us in the instance that you have some sort of loss or theft of your bike. Slide here with Sergeant Bies. With my predecessor, Sergeant Ransom, I think he used Sergeant Bies' help as well as Keep Calm Toolkit, and the River Forest Police Department purchased Keep Calm sensory kits for each of our frontline cars. They're designed in collaboration with police and EMTs to help special needs populations cope with their emotions, self-regulate, manage stress, and help with restlessness during an emergency. Each tool and resource in these kits was hand-selected, tested, and chosen by adults and children living with various mental health disorders or autism. So how can you help? Spread the word. Donate to provide these kits like these to other departments. Find a way to get involved there. Wanted to bring up, there's a picture of those. Those are the sensory kits. You can see there's a variety of items in there, and it just helps us maybe to make that connection with people that are going through that on different calls. Calms them down, it helps us regulate the situation better. So National Prescription Take Back Day, that is this Saturday, the 27th. You can safely dispose of unused, expired, or unwanted prescriptions and over-the-counter medications from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the River Forest Police Department. If you're unable to take part in National Prescription Drug Take Back Day on the 27th, we do have a prescription drop box located in the basement of Village Hall, and that's available to residents Monday through Friday during normal business hours. Just remember that it's unwise and it's unsafe to throw out, flush, or leave unused prescriptions in your cabinets. So this is the DEA's National Prescription Take Back Day, and that is a picture of the receptacle we have basement of Village Hall. So please feel free to stop by and do that. Sorry, I'm going opposite way. Okay, we just wanted to do a quick reminder about some of the River Forest Police Department's free services. We have the Emergency ID Bracelet Program, which is similar to what Sergeant Bies was discussing. These are red bracelets that we end up imprinting or engraving. We have them engraved with information, so that way if someone is, for instance, nonverbal, or we are trying to figure out where they live to get them home because they can't remember anything like that, they have a number on the bracelet, and then it'll say a few important things underneath it, such as nonverbal, or trying to think, maybe they have a sensory issue, just something to make you aware, an allergy. This is also used by the fire department. So if someone has an allergy to a certain medication, just anything important, you can choose what goes on the front of that. It doesn't have your personal information, such as your name or address. It has our phone number, and our officers know that if they see these bracelets, they can look up in the program we have frontline online that's only available to us, and we can find out the information about that person to help them get home safely and or figure out how we can make the incident or situation better for them. We also have, like I said, we have Frontline, so that is the portal where you can do overnight parking, you can enter vacation watches, and as well as the key holder portal, and that's for residences and businesses, and you can put important information on there that we have access to, whether or not you have cameras, such as a Ring camera, anything like that, you can have that on there in the event that there's a crime that occurs and we are looking to access video footage. We also have the residential security surveys. This is a free service offered by the police department. People come out and look at your residence and kind of go over some different areas where there could be improvements or tell you what, you know, this looks great. It's helpful. We have Hyundai and Kia steering wheel locks available. We also offer child safety seat inspections. We did an event, believe it was last fall, where it was in the River Forest Town Center. We had people come by where we could help install safety seats, and we will show you how, so that way it also educates you on how you can do it properly. iSearch is a program that we have been running. I do it with Kim Wojak, and it's grades kindergarten 2, 4, 6, and 8. We go into the schools and we do individual classroom presentations with those different grades to talk about safety, and it's obviously tailored to age. So as the grades go, we end up getting a little deeper into the information there. Too Good for Drugs is for fifth grade classes that just wrapped up for the year. It's 10 weeks that we, the River Forest Police Department, goes and we can talk to the fifth grade classes about building confidence, making good decisions, and we go from there into lessons about drug, alcohol abuse. Junior Citizens Police Academy is coming up, and I have another slide here for that. Applications should be available, I would guess, next week, beginning of next week. So keep an eye on the village website for that. You can always stop in the police department to get one. If you are interested in it, you can send me an email, and I can put you on an interest list for that. There we go. Upcoming events. So the Memorial Day Parade is going to be May 27th. This is always a really great event. Hopefully we have good weather for it. Also, the Junior Citizens Police Academy, like I said, that is going to be August 5th through August 9th of this year. And typically that runs about 9 a.m. until 3 p.m. Monday through Friday. So like I said, that information will be coming out and applications will become available. Now I'm going to turn it over to Detective Zerbino.
Good evening, everybody. Excuse me a little bit. I've got allergies going on and some other stuff. My name is Detective Denise Armando. I'm one of the investigators for the police department. I just want a couple of quick reminders for everybody now that the weather's getting nice and, you know, there's foot traffic and everyone's going on their bike rides and walks and, you know, enjoying the evening weather when it's nice enough to go for. I want to go over some popular trends that we see once the weather starts getting a little nicer. The first one being burglaries. Once the weather starts getting nicer, we start seeing an increase in our burglaries. That could be vehicle, that could be, vehicle burglaries, bike burglaries in garages and stuff that's left in the yards and unlocked vehicles and sometimes even residences. So just a couple of things to keep in mind. You know, if you are out of town, making sure that your residence does not look unoccupied when you're not home. That may be for, you know, your evening walk, whether you're gone for the weekend or, you know, taking a small trip out of town. Officer Drake mentioned, there is some services that we offer to kind of assist with any sort of vacation stays that you might, vacations you might be going on, or, you know, some services that we offer to assist you with increasing the security on your property. When you are going outside or out of town, making sure that you all of your stuff locked. That's windows, doors, storm doors if applicable, your vehicles, do not ever leave car keys inside of the cars, that sort of stuff, even if that means you're going to be gone for a 30-minute walk or, you know, overnight. That's when we see, you know, a lot of people get stuff breaking into because they're leaving stuff unlocked overnight. Keep your garage doors also locked. I know a lot of us tend to use the garage door as our main entry point, and sometimes, you know, running in with the children or running in with pets, groceries, whatever it is, make sure that you're locking the doors. If applicable, put some sensors on it or some sort of reminder that allows you to keep that door locked. And you know, we do our best to ride around at nighttime or whenever possible, and ring your doorbell if it's not too late at night, or remind you that your door's closed. Take a look around, make sure nothing's missing. If we do stumble upon something like that, or, you know, again, you leave your trunk open while you were taking out the groceries, we will leave a crime hazard alert just with a few safety tips and making sure that you contact us if something does seem to have been removed or out of place. Some other tips, there's, you know, don't wait to be a victim of any sort of burglary or stuff taken from your property or from your residence to think about these things. You want to make sure that, you know, you're investing in your valuables and your property. So time and motion sensor lights, it's nothing new that those tend to deter people from coming near your residence. You know, criminals don't like light. They don't like being seen. So those really help with keeping people off of your property and deterring some crime in our town. If you're going to be out of town, consider making some delivery arrangements while you're away, whether that's the neighbor picking up your stuff, if it's an extended trip out of state, making sure, you know, you rearrange for that to be delivered to a post office or holding it for pickup at a later date. I highly suggest that storing anything in your yard. We do get an increase of bike thefts once the weather gets nice. The kids are running out, get lunch, coming back out. Bikes disappear. They're leaving them there overnight. You know, want to make sure that you're storing that stuff in the garage. If it is in the yard, it's locked away, or the yard is, you know, not accessible from the exterior to people that might not be welcomed onto your property. Again, invest in your property security. You don't want to wait till you're missing, you know, an $800-$900 bike, or worse comes, you know, a car or some sort of valuable that's a family heirloom that, you know, now is gone because you didn't invest in your property. My last tip would be recording any valuables, whether that's, you know, on some sort of list that you create at home. It always assists us with any investigations. And if you unfortunately are a victim of a crime, whether that's expensive jewelry, having, you know, some sort of paperwork on it, photographing it, documenting it, serial numbers to weapons, serial numbers to electronics, serial numbers to bikes. We offer free bike registration. Make sure you take advantage of that. That comes in handy. And, if, you know, it works the same way as a vehicle. If we happen to stop someone that shouldn't be on your on your bike, we're able to identify the registered owner and, you know, make contact with you a lot quicker and get your property back if it was taken. And once again, a reminder that we do offer vacation watches, and that will prompt you to provide us with any sort of information on your property that if for whatever reason looks out of place, we would know, because that's all documented in your system, whether there's time lights, whether the lights are off and now we're driving past property. Go and make sure, you know, someone didn't leave the light on, or potentially someone, you know, God forbid, broke into your house. So just some more tips there. I have a little video that I wanted to share. Another thing that we see often in the area, once there's landscaping companies, contractors getting work done on the house, so there's a lot of trucks from out of town that are in and out. We try our best to identify them, but a lot of times, you know, they're in and out so fast that we cannot possibly identify them before it's too late. So I'm going to share a video. Hopefully it works. Just walk through it. Just walk.
Sorry, please.
That's okay. I can narrate it if you'd like.
easier.
That's fine. If the note doesn't work, you can just let it play and it kind of, you know, it's self-explanatory and I can just walk through it. Serves as a reminder of what who shouldn't be showing up at your door. Okay, we can skip it. That's fine. Yeah, no, the next slide basically covers. So another trend that we see a lot once the weather, like I said, gets nice and there's vehicles in and out of town, contracting and soliciting scams. Don't fall victim to that. I took the liberty of interviewing every department that we have in this village to kind of see what their process looks like and what they carry on their person to make sure that, you know, you're aware of who's showing up at your door and why you should and shouldn't answer to those people. Just for information, our contractors will always show up or village employees will always show up with an ID. If they're not wearing it, it's probably not a village employee. They're all, and I'll stress this again, they're all in marked vehicles. The fire department's not going to show up in the personal car. Village employees usually have a marked vehicle. If it's not marked, there's at least the village plate on it. If not, they'll have an ID. There's no reason why they should not be showing you an ID. You never want to open the doors to someone that you don't know. Anyone that's soliciting, and they're required to register with the police department. They are also told that they have to carry their registration with them so that if they do get stopped by police, they can show that they are permitted to be soliciting door-to-door for whatever reason. If anyone is not showing you that, my main advice is do not open your door. You're not going to hurt anyone's feelings. So just move on to the next one. That's why you can call us and we'll verify that they're legit. And if they have a permit, they should have no reason to not show it to you. Okay. So some of the common scams that we see here are home repair fraud, debt repair, and ruse burglaries. I'll kind of give you a little gist of what each one of those is since the video didn't work. So home repair fraud, the common themes that we see are contractors that are soliciting work at your door. Contractors don't have the time to solicit at your door. They're usually word of mouth. They're usually, you know, called to your residence. If you're at home and you're not expecting a visit from a contractor, that's probably a scam. Even if the village happens to send someone, you can always call the village and they will confirm that they're sending someone over. The one we see often is we're doing work in the neighborhood. We're doing work with, you know, your neighbor down the street. We're, you know, I can fix your chimney. I can do some tuck pointing real quick. I can steal your house. If you didn't solicit, don't do it. They might have flyers. They might have business cards. They might have a marked car with a, you know, one of those cheap little magnet things that you can stick on it. All of those are red flags. Do not do it. Call the police. Don't even open the door. Again, you're not going to hurt their feelings if we show up and they're legit, then they're legit, and they'll move on. Cash repairs, again, that goes hand in hand with everything. If they are coming to your door and offering to seal your garage or seal the house for cash, or, you know, their price might start at $300 and now you're paying $1,000 for services that you didn't even asked to get done in the first place, another red flag. Don't open the door, period. Okay. They're also, they pressure you, so that's not a good sign. stunt repair scams are usually more in vehicles. They tend to approach people that are in parking lots. They tend to approach people that are driving next to them. They'll ask them to pull over, point you to whatever damage your vehicle has and offer to fix it right on the spot for a very low price. We just had a victim that did an awesome job, had a dash cam, and he got pulled over. He agreed to a service, again, was pressured into kind of getting the service. He did an excellent job at, telling the guy that he needed to go to the bank to get the money because they wanted cash. While on the way to the bank that was across the street, he was on the phone with us. He was able to give us all the information of the vehicle, the people in the vehicle. We were able to make an arrest on the spot. If you feel pressured and it's not something that you even solicited, don't do it. Most of the time, again, they're just going to move on and go on to the next one. Best thing you can do is either get us a license plate and inform us of what happened, a picture, if it's safe to do so. Again, if it's safe to do so, do not force anyone to take a picture. They're just going to move on. Let it go. And most of the time, they're just damaging your vehicle. They're putting stuff on there that's not meant to be put on cars and ask you to leave it on for 24 hours, and then now you have permanent damage that was worse than, the little dent that was already in your vehicle. And then the last one that I just want to cover, this one's more commonly targeted towards elderly residents, but we've also seen it with, younger residents. Ruse burglaries, this is where I stress the departments, the building department, code enforcement, utility companies, fire department that show up at your door, your neighbors having an emergency, again, pressure in effect. I need to get in your house, check your water pressure. I was sent here from the water department, the fire department in a yellow vest, red flag. I spoke with the fire department. They will never show up in a personal car. They will always show up in a probably $1 million engine that is pretty hard to miss. And even if they do that, they probably won't go in your house without prior notice. So make sure that you ask for ID. If you don't feel comfortable, the hairs in the back of your neck are standing up, don't even open the door and just call us. That's what we're here for. That's what we're getting paid to do. Do not exit your home for whatever reason if a stranger requests it. The Ruse burglary, that's usually what they do. They either get you in the house, in the secluded part of the house, usually the basement, somewhere where they distract you while other people are, rummaging through your valuables. And most people don't notice it until everything has happened, which is usually within a very, very, very short time frame. Call 911, even if you're unsure. The link at the bottom, I just provided it to whoever need to look up a licensed contractor. The village provides a list of any licensed contractor registered with the village. So if you need to verify someone at your door that you're very interested in hiring, always make sure you're doing a background check, making sure that maybe if a reference, or even if you can check this list and you'll be able to verify that they're a better business bureau as well. So those are just some tips. We're hoping that this helps prevent any victimizing it with our residents. And, we're working collaboratively with our code enforcement and a building department to make sure that if they see also some red flags or a person in the town that looks like they might not be doing legit work, they will contact us and we can address it promptly.
Well, this is the time of the evening where we respond to any questions from our online audience or our in-person audience. So we had a question asked a little bit earlier by a member of the audience to the retired sergeant from Madison, just reference how many CIT officers should be on each shift. We have a good number of our officers. The goal is 100%. We have a good percentage of our officers that are trained and certified in CIT, but that's not all. They also receive extensive training in de-escalation. We are a dementia-friendly community. They also receive training in the area of dementia and Alzheimer's and how to manage those situations more efficiently. So each shift, we'll have people working that can assist with our special needs communities or those that are in crisis. I also just want to thank the great guest speakers tonight, not only retired Sergeant Bias, but our speaker from the bike exchange. That's been a great run, and we hope it continues and it's very successful. Also, Detective Cimeno, thank you for your presentation tonight, and also Officer Drake for putting this together this evening. If there's any questions from the audience, we'd be more than glad to take them now. All right, at this time, we have no questions coming in. One thing I do want to mention is we operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. So at any time you do have a question, reach out, give a call. We also have supervisors that work 24 hours a day. So if you're not sure who to talk to, just ask to speak with the supervisor, and you'll have the ability to field your inquiry through them, and they'll determine the best resource within the agency or maybe an outside resource that can assist you. And remember, if something's going on, as we talk about, if you see something, say something, you hear something, say something, call 911. You know, people might say, you know, I don't know the non-emergency number. I don't want to look it up. Just call 911. The dispatchers aren't going to be mad at you. They're going to understand that this was important to you and that you needed to reach them as soon as possible. And most of the time, your instincts are going to be correct. They're going to be spot on that something isn't right. So please just call 911. Don't second guess yourself. And I'll check one more time to see if we have any other questions. No questions coming in. So I'd like to wish everyone a great Wednesday evening. And please be safe and stay alert out there.